Well, last time I was, I finished talking about random fields, which are, a random variable. So I had talked about the 1D case, which I like to think of as a time stream. And they're actually simplest to think about in Fourier space, where the translation invariance implies that a random field is just a collection of independent Gaussian random numbers, one for every Fourier mode. And now I want to just say a few words about the generalization to more than one dimension. And there's really nothing new here compared to the 1D case. Let me just sort of summarize for completeness. In cosmology, we're just going to be interested in 2D and 3D random fields. So there's a correlation function. Let me denote the random field in this case. But in 2D, I'm always thinking about the sky as being the 2D place where the field lives. And in 3D, I might be thinking of a constant time slice of the universe. So let me denote the field by phi. And if it's a 2D field or a 3D field, I'll denote the spatial coordinate by something like x either way. Call this x prime. So there's a correlation function. And there's nothing new in the 2D case that didn't happen in the 1D case. So if I have a random field in 2D, the correlation between the field values at two locations in the 2D plane, that would be some function. If I assume translation invariance, then the correlation only depends on the separation. And if I additionally assume rotation invariance, then the correlation function just depends on the length of the separation, not its vector direction. So as in the 1D case, the correlation function is a function of a single scalar argument, the distance between the points. And likewise in 3D. There is a power spectrum. I'll write this way. All cosmologists are hardwired to write a 2D Fourier wave numbers as L and 3D Fourier wave numbers as K. I remember thinking this was weird when I started learning cosmology, but it had become hardwired. So if I try to use K in 2D, it just seems wrong and my brain revolts. So this is a power spectrum, which depends, has the translation invariance implies that the translation invariance implies that the right-hand side here contains the delta function in wave number. If the star were omitted here, this would be a plus instead of a minus. The rotation invariance implies that the argument only depends on the length of the wave number L, not its direction. So the functional form on the right-hand side here follows from symmetry, and the free function that is allowed by the symmetry is the definition of the power spectrum. And same thing over here, we just call it the wave number K. So in 2D, we usually write CL for the power spectrum, not P of L. Sometimes either notation is used. Cubed. All right, and then there's the theorem that says that the correlation function and power spectrum contain the same information and that one can be obtained from the other by Fourier transform. It's called the Wigner-Kinchin theorem. And the way it works, it's easy to derive this, just follow the argument that we used in 1D. The way it works in 2D is that the power spectrum is obtained by taking a 2D Fourier transform of the correlation function. The only thing to watch out for here is that the relevant Fourier transform is a 2D Fourier transform. The function that you're taking the 2D Fourier transform of, the correlation function, only depends on the length of L, not its direction. So it's the Fourier transform of an azimuthally symmetric function in 2D. The Fourier transform of an azimuthally symmetric function in 2D, the 2D Fourier transform, is another 2D function which is azimuthally symmetric, which is why the right-hand side here only depends on... this should have been an X. Oh, yeah. Basically, I had everything wrong in this equation. It should be d2x theta of x e to the il dot x. Okay, so I'm taking the 2D Fourier transform of an azimuthally symmetric function. I get another azimuthally symmetric function, which is why the right-hand side here only depends on the direction of L as notationally consistent with the left-hand side. Likewise, over here, the power spectrum and the correlation function are 3D Fourier transforms of each other. Now, here's a little exercise, a little calculation involving random fields. What is, if I have a, I'll put it on the side and then I'll add a row to the table here. What is the variance of the field phi in real space? What's the expectation value of phi squared? The answer turns out to be that it's just the integral. Let's say this is a 2D random field. It's just the integral of the power spectrum. One way to derive that is to just write out phi of x in Fourier space, write it as the integral over d2l over 2 pi squared zeta of l e to the il dot x, and then put two copies of that and then take the expectation value. This is what you get. Another way to see it is to notice that what I have here on the left-hand side is just the correlation function evaluated at zero separation. In general, the correlation function is at some separation s is just the two-point function of two x's separated by displacement s. And here I have two phis at the same point, so correlation function at zero separation. And for any separation, the correlation function, you know, it would be the inverse Fourier transform of the power spectrum. And in particular, if I plug in zero separation on the left-hand side, then this factor becomes one, and I just have the integral of the power spectrum. So the variance of the field is the correlation function at zero lag or the integral of the power spectrum. And sometimes this is written in a different way. If you write it as with a d log L, if you integrate over the azimuthal coordinate and write it as an integral over log L, then the integrand is L squared C of L over 2 pi. That combination, L squared C L over 2 pi, is sometimes denoted delta of L. It's just a synonym for the power spectrum, but with this extra weighting put in. And that's always what appears in plots. So when you see a power spectrum plotted, like the famous plot of the CMB power spectrum that you've undoubtedly seen in many talks, the axes are almost always log L versus L squared CL over 2 pi. That particular choice of axes, or delta L, I just wanted to motivate this axis. The reason this is what's always on the axis is because it lets you this will have some units, like this peak, is that 6,000 micro k squared in the CMB? It lets you eyeball how much power is in the field. This numerical value is the power per unit log L, the power for every factor of E that you take in L. So in these axes, the integral under the curve will be some number with units of micro k squared. And if you take the square root of that, you get the size of a typical CMB fluctuation. So in the CMB, you know, this peaks at 6,000, and there's a few E foldings. We sometimes say E folding for one factor of E and L, or one step in log L. You might conclude that the area under this curve is of order 10 to the 4, and the typical CMB fluctuation is of size 10 to the 2 micro k, and that's the right answer. In 3D, the only difference is you have a d3k over 2 pi cubed. So I integrate the power spectrum with this 1/3d with this 1/2 pi cubed weighting to get the variance. If you want to rewrite that as an integral over log k, then what you end up with here is k squared p of k, sorry, k cubed p of k over 2 pi squared. And that combination is defined to be delta of k in 3D. In any number of dimensions, the definition of delta is just what appears next to the d log k in the integral. Another thing that's worth pointing out is that the power spectrum is scale invariant. A field is scale invariant. If and only if the power spectrum falls off as 1/L² in 2D, or 1/K³ in 3D. It's always 1/ the number of dimensions. This is actually going to be a tutorial problem to show that formally. I will point out in lecture that you can actually see this from dimensional analysis. I didn't talk about the units, but let's say that phi is a dimensionless quantity. What units would the power spectrum have? You can read them off from this equation if you remember that the units of a delta function are always the inverse of the units of its argument. There's more than one thing to say. So first off, I skipped a step. So let's say phi of x is dimensionless. What would the units be of phi tilde of k? The answer depends on which Fourier conventions you take, but in my Fourier conventions, this is the integral of d3x, phi of x, e to the ik dot x. The Fourier transform of a dimensionless field actually has units of volume. To read off the units of the power spectrum, we go to this equation. I have two phis on the left-hand side, and they each have units of volume, because they're phi k's, not phi x. This delta function also has units of volume. In general, the delta function has the inverse units of its argument. Here, the argument is a k, a wave number. So when I invert that, I get a length, and there are three delta functions. So this has units of volume, two volumes here. And so the power spectrum also has units of volume. Those are useful things to remember. If the power spectrum has units of volume, and it's also proportional to 1/K³, which has units of volume, then the constant factor that sits in front of the proportionality is dimensionless. So I can specify the power spectrum purely with a dimensionless quantity. There are no dimensionful parameters that I need to specify. And that's consistent with scale invariant. Scale invariant means there's no scale, no preferred scale. You don't need any dimensionful parameters to describe the power spectrum. If I tried to use a different exponent here, like 1 over k squared, then of course this would have to have units of length, and I've defined a scale. This counting of units also shows that the delta quantity that I defined here is dimensionless. If that is if the field phi is dimensionless, otherwise it would have the square of the units of phi, which is why in the CMB case this has units of microkelvin squared, because the field I'm taking the power spectrum of is the CMB temperature in microk. Okay, so basically, this is all I had to say about the 2 and 3D case. It's pretty much the same as the 1D case, but there are a few minor things to say. So now, the reason, going back to the first or second lecture, the reason that I started talking about random fields in the first place is that I wanted to sort of unpack the specification of the standard model of cosmology as a sequence of bullet points and explain what all the bullet points mean. So one of the bullet points was that the initial fluctuations are Gaussian random. And now I can tell you precisely what that means. What it precisely means is that the initial metric of the universe. So this is at this equation is understood to apply at very early times, very shortly after the Big Bang. Is this? So this is a perturbed FRW metric. Where the coefficient of dx squared is the FRW scale factor, which depends on t, times this function, which depends on x, but not t. And this function zeta is called the adiabatic curvature. This form of the metric can be explained by models of the early universe like inflation. It will generate this type of metric in the initial conditions of the hot Big Bang. But for now, let's just take it as an axiom. It's just one of the assumptions of the standard model. Zeta is a random, a Gaussian random 3D field. Truly random. It's because its fluctuations are quantum mechanically random. With power spectrum. So the power spectrum is usually written as a formula for delta of k, which remember means k cubed p of k over 2 pi squared in 3D. So there's some constant, which is a parameter of the model. This is a thing that's 2.11 plus or minus 0.05 times 10 to the minus 9. If that were all there were on the right-hand side, then we would be saying that the initial conditions of the universe were scale invariant with this amplitude, or rather the square root of this number would be the characteristic amplitude. But it's also part of the model that there is a small change, a small deviation from scale invariance is observed. So it's that deviation is written like this, where ns is something like 0.967. This is called the spectral index. For historical reasons,
The spectral index is defined so that the scale invariant case corresponds to ns equals 1. So this is a number a little bit less than 1. Would have made a little more sense to define it without the minus 1 here, so that this would be a number a little bit less than 0. But that's the convention. This k0 is not really a parameter of the model. It's just some reference wave number where the power spectrum gets evaluated. If you were to use a different convention for that reference wave number, it would just change the quoted value of delta zeta a little bit, because this is a slowly varying function of scale, and it would not change ns. So if you want to simulate on the computer the initial conditions of our universe, you would just take our observable Hubble volume, put it in a big box so that you can do Fourier transforms, loop over every wave number of the box. Each wave number will have some value of k. And in the corresponding Fourier mode, I evaluate this power spectrum. So I would evaluate p of k. So I would put in the k cubed over 2 pi squared. Generate two Gaussian random numbers with square root of p of k. One of those will be the real part of the Fourier mode. One of those will be the imaginary part of the Fourier mode. Now I have computed a random realization of zeta in Fourier space. And I just take the Fourier transform to get zeta of x and set the initial fluctuations in the metric. So Gaussian random numbers are built into cosmology in this model because they're in the initial conditions. Now for the most, well, this isn't 100% true, but a lot of the time, the things that we observe in cosmology are complicated linear combinations of these of this initial perturbation. For example, the CMB, there is some very complicated physics by which you get from a realization of this 3D field in the initial conditions to the 2D CMB, the 2D T of theta phi that we observe today. And we'll talk about as much of that physics as we can under the constraints of a 3-week class. One thing I want to say about the physics from the very beginning is that it's linear. It's a very, think you can imagine a very complicated linear black box where the CMB, once this is specified throughout our Hubble volume, the initial zeta, then the CMB temperature that we observe in a given sky location is just some linear combination of zeta values throughout our Hubble volume. That implies there was a theorem that if I apply a linear operation to a Gaussian field, I get another Gaussian field. And that's true even if the Gaussian fields have different numbers of dimensions. Like here, I'm linearly processing a 3D field into a 2D field. And that's why RCMB is a Gaussian random field, because it's linear physics applied to Gaussian initial conditions. The same is true of like the matter fluctuations in our universe. At least if you smooth them out, or equivalently, if you look at Fourier wave numbers of sufficiently large wavelength, they're Gaussian distributed. On small scales, that's not true. The matter has had time to evolve nonlinearly, so it's clumped up into. On small scales, you know, the matter distribution might look like a bunch of clumped up dark matter halos with filaments connecting them, a very non-Gaussian field. But if I average over wavelengths of, 20 megaparsecs or more, then the matter fluctuations in our universe also look like are Gaussian random distributed. They are a Gaussian random field that are obtained by some complicated linear processing of the initial conditions. So that's basically how cosmology works, is that we observe all of these Gaussian fields, and then we try to compute for a given set of cosmological parameters how they were obtained by linearly processing the initial fluctuations. And then we try to do a bunch of data analysis to pin down the parameters and figure out what's going on. I've now explained, I think I've now said what all of the parameters of the standard model mean. I'll list them again. It's a 6-parameter model. So these are parameters of the expansion history. These we talked about in the FRW review. And these have now been, we really fleshed out the theory of random fields and explained what these meant. And the meaning of tau, the optical depth to the CMB, is easy to explain. It's just the probability, this is a number of order 6%, order 0.06. 6% is the probability that a CMB photon emitted at a very high redshift scatters off an electron in the low redshift universe before it reaches us. I haven't explained everything about this standard cosmological model yet. For example, one of the bullet points was to say that the initial conditions were adiabatic scalar initial conditions, and I haven't explained what that that means yet, but we're making progress. Yes?
Something I don't understand. So this two parameters that you have in delta k, these are input parameters, or do you get it from the simulation, or are these experimental numbers?
Okay. You're asking about these numbers, the delta zeta and the ns.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. So from the point of view of doing data analysis, these are experimental numbers. These are just something that we try to measure. The challenge for theory is to come up with a model of the early universe that matches them. And so for a given model of the early universe, like if I, you know, one thing that I plan to talk about in the class is slow roll inflation, where the initial perturbations are generated by the quantum mechanics of a scalar field falling down a given potential. And so if a model is specified, like this model, then you can calculate in that model what delta zeta and ns you should get. For example, for this model, inflation on a quadratic potential, which is maybe the aesthetically simplest model of the early universe one could imagine, it doesn't really do a good job of agreeing with the data. It's disfavored at something like 2.5 sigma. Something that I like to say in like 5 minutes is that I think it's useful to say this, that this counting of parameters is actually a little subjective. For example, if you go back to the FRW review, you might think that we have one parameter too few here in the expansion history. And if we undo this weird cosmologist parameterization, then the numbers that we need are just the density of baryons today, the density of matter today, which is... when I say matter, when I write something with an M subscript, I always mean baryons plus cold dark matter. The cosmological constant and the radiation density today. I need four numbers. If I count, I need four numbers to determine the expansion history, whereas I only have three here. And this is just a subjectivity in the counting. The one way to think about the fourth parameter is that it's like a clock-like parameter that tells you when you're making the observations. Or another way to think about it is that the CMB temperature is the hidden fourth parameter, which converts directly to a value of rho radiation. And this is like a clock. This is the number that's counting down with time. This isn't counted, but that's just a convention. I guess that the experimentalists don't like to count it because this is so well measured. The error here is something like 0.003. It's pinned down to about one part in 1,000. From the point of view of doing data analysis, you can just treat it, this error is negligible, and you can just treat it as something that's known a priori, and so no one ever has to think about it, it's not included in the count. From the point of view of fundamental physics, there's always a clock-like parameter, which is the time that you make the observations, which is something you can never try to predict in a fundamental theory. So from either perspective, it sort of makes sense to remove a parameter. Something else. The optical depth is actually not a fundamental parameter of the theory, in the sense that if we understood like the physics of star formation perfectly, and the physics of quasars and supernovae and a bunch of messy astrophysics, then in theory it would be derivable from the other parameters. And these are really the fundamental parameters that determine the expansion of the universe in their initial conditions. And nature, after all, determines tau from those parameters. Once these are specified, then the number density of stars and quasars in the universe and how much light they emit to reionize photons is just some deterministic process. But we have no way of calculating it. So for the point of view of data analysis, it's a parameter that we have to measure from the observations. It's really important, by the way, because, I mean, you might wonder who cares about this, what fraction of electrons in the universe were ionized by starlight between now and the Big Bang. But it's important because it turns out to have a big accidental degeneracy with other parameters that are more exciting. For example, it's currently kind of an important thing to think about in cosmology, how we're going to end up measuring the neutrino mass. It turns out that when you combine the CMB with other things, and this is a very non-obvious thing that requires a lot of analysis, a change in the neutrino mass on the things that we measure, like the CMB power spectrum, is pretty degenerate with a change in tau. So we need a better way, actually, in cosmology to measure them independently. And there's some question of whether our near future observations of the neutrino mass are really going to be limited by the statistics of our observation or just by degeneracy with tau. While I'm on the subject of neutrino mass, I should say that, I mean, the six-parameter model is really great. It's really an amazing fact that the large-scale evolution of our universe is described by a model with so few ingredients. But what we really are interested in is knowing whether we need more parameters. So for example, detecting a non-zero neutrino mass in cosmology, adding that parameter to the list, that's a really interesting thing to do. If the six-parameter model just holds up forever, then just simply decreasing the error bars on all of these quantities would not actually be all that interesting. We just decrease them in the hopes that we'll measure something new. Some parameters that we... So cosmology is largely the business of like parameterizing all possible surprises or extensions to this model that might be useful to look for. If you don't know what to look for, you might not see it. And so I could list about, if I wanted to be exhaustive, maybe 50 to 100 different extensions of this model that we talk about. But I'm just going to list like the big four, my top four. So one is neutrino mass. It would be really cool if we could measure the absolute scale of the neutrino mass in cosmology. And that is something that might actually happen in the next 5 years or so. Another number that's very interesting is the number of neutrino species, which is 3 in the standard model. And in cosmology, you'll often see the notation N effective. What we really measure is the number of light or relativistic degrees of freedom in the early universe, which could be, in the standard model, that would only be neutrinos. But if, for example, there were a light scalar field around that we didn't know about, it would contribute. This is a case, actually, where the error bars will get much better in the next five or 10 years. They'll get like a factor of 10 better. Number 4 on my list is W, the equation of state of dark energy. In the standard model, the dark energy is a cosmological constant with W equals minus 1. But that's an observation. The error bar on that is about 0.1. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but roughly the current central value for W is around minus 1, and it has a statistical error of around 0.1. But it's very interesting to just parameterize the dark energy by, let's say we call it rho lambda 0 times a to the minus 3 times 1 plus W dark energy. And see whether it's really consistent with a cosmological constant or there's some evolution with time. And number four that you hear about a lot is R, the amplitude of gravity waves. I'll explain how the parameter R is a dimensionless number, and I'll explain exactly how it's defined later, but it's essentially the amplitude of gravity waves in the initial conditions. If there are cosmological gravity waves in the initial conditions, they would perturb this metric. And some models of inflation predict that they would be there, and others don't. There was a big high-profile affair a couple of years ago where everyone thought that there was that this had been detected. And then it turned out to be contamination by thermal emission by dust grains at microwave wavelengths showing up in the CMB. So the data are back to being consistent with R equals zero. This one is really exciting because this is another case where the error bars will get way, way better pretty soon. If we see it, I think it really narrows down. Whether we see it or we don't, we learn something either way. It really narrows down our ideas about what's going on in the early universe. Next, I'm going to show some pictures. I've been talking about these random fields, but I think the pictures supplementing the equations really give a lot of helpful intuition. I'm going to show some random fields. These are going to be 2D random fields. Here's a 2D random field with a scale invariant power spectrum. I want to emphasize that these plots are very easy to make. Like all of the code that I wrote to make the slides in this plot took a total of maybe an hour or two to write working. They're always watching. It's like Big Brother. To simulate a 2D Gaussian random field with a given power spectrum, all I do is work in Fourier space. I simulate a bunch of modes whose amplitude at wave number L is the square root of C of L. That gives me the random field in Fourier space, and then I take the Fourier transform and make this plot. So here's the scale invariant random field. This has the property that if I take a sub box and zoom out to the size of the original box, it would look statistically indistinguishable. So there's no preferred scale in these fluctuations. If I steepen the power spectrum at long wavelengths, I get this. Here you can see that relative to the previous plot, things are smoothed out on small scales. There's less structure. And the fluctuations are larger on large scales. Like this large scale cold spot is exaggerated, and so is this large scale hot spot relative to the previous plot. Here's a blue power spectrum where I make it one power of L more blue than the scale invariant case. And you can see the long wavelength fluctuations are gone, and there's more power on small scales now. Here's white noise. Here's a scale invariant power spectrum with a cutoff. So I just took a scale invariant power spectrum and then put in this exponential factor that cuts off the power at some point. And so this would be scale invariant on wavelengths above some characteristic scale. And then below that, everything is exponentially suppressed. So the very small wavelength fluctuations here are exponentially suppressed. So there's a characteristic scale on the plots. Here's a fun example, the delta function power spectrum. So you can see here, there's just a very sharply defined characteristic wave number. In the 1D case, if you took the power spectrum to be a delta function, then you would be saying that there's only one non-zero Fourier mode, and the time stream would be a pure sinusoid. In the 2D case, what happens is that this is a 1D delta function, so you can think of the allowed wave numbers as a ring in the Fourier plane. And this map in real space is the superposition of a bunch of plane waves pointing in different directions but with the same wave number. And so you can see it's more complicated than just a pure sinusoid in 1D, But when you combine all of those differently oriented sinusoids with the same wavelength, there's a very sharply defined characteristic scale. Like all of these hot and cold spots have a very sharply defined characteristic size. Now what happens in the CMB is sort of a weaker version of this. So I talked about a case, I showed an example. Now I plot L squared CL over 2 pi here. The CMB is usually plotted with a plus 1. In this plot, scale invariant would mean that the line were constant. And so one thing that happens in the CMB is that you're suppressing power on wavelengths smaller than some characteristic scale, similar to that example that I showed before with the exponential cutoff. And then the other thing that happens is you have these spikes at characteristic frequencies. Now, it's sometimes claimed in talks that you can see this characteristic scale on the maps. I showed the delta function case where it was really sharply defined. And here, this is not a delta function. It's sometimes claimed that there's some characteristic scale, which would be around a degree. The hot and cold spots in the CMB, you can see by eye that they have that characteristic scale. When I made the plot, I wasn't sure if I agreed with that at all. Let me do this in the other order. I'll go back to this slide in a sec. Here's a Gaussian map with the same power spectrum as the CMB. And this map is visually indistinguishable from a real CMB map. Like if I made 5 simulations and then I gave you 5 CMB maps from Planck, I don't think you would be able to tell which 5 were the data and which 5 were the simulations. I'm not sure I'm convinced that. One thing that you can see in this map very clearly is this cutoff. There is no... There is sort of a minimum size to the hot and cold spots in this map below which power is suppressed. But I'm not sure that you can see the presence of the peaks by eye. Here's a scale invariant power spectrum with a cutoff, and here's the CMB. I tried to convince myself that there was some like very characteristic size of the hot and cold spots in the CMB map, but I couldn't quite convince myself that was true. I put this slide in just as a reminder that the CMB power spectrum contains the same information as its correlation function. You can go from one to the other by a Fourier transform. This is a plot from a WMAP paper that I put in just because I was too lazy to write code to compute the Fourier transform and plot it myself. This curve, the black curve is the data. This thin solid curve is the theory correlation function, that is to say the Fourier transform of the theory power spectrum. So the correlation function is a little more intuitive. Like this dip means, suppose you were sitting in a CMB hotspot. So you're at a point, you're looking at a point in the sky where the CMB temperature is positive. Then there would be a statistical tendency for the nearby points to also be hotspots. But a point that was, say, 80 degrees away, there would be a statistical tendency for it to be a cold spot. That's what the correlation function means. The power spectrum is maybe not quite as intuitive, but it's more convenient for data analysis. And I think it's also maybe more helpful to look at. You can see a lot more structure here than it's more directly connected, more intuitively connected to the physics than the correlation function. I was kind of vague about how you fit cosmological parameters out of the CMB. So just for fun, sometimes I like to do like hand-wavy statements that I'm going to prove later in the class. Just for fun, I'll just show you one example. Before the CMB is formed, the universe is a plasma. The physics of the universe is linear perturbations evolving in the plasma. The plasma has a sound speed. And there's some maximum distance. There's some distance that a sound wave travels between the CMB and the time when the CMB is formed, recombination, the time when the universe goes from being a plasma to being transparent. And so the sound horizon is just the co-moving distance that a sound wave travels. And that's what we see in the CMB. The acoustic peaks are telling us that scale. So more precisely, if S is the sound horizon, the co-moving distance the sound wave can travel before the CMB is formed, and then tau is the is the size of the observable universe, or equivalently the conformal time back to the CMB, then the ratio of those numbers is this is the value of L, where the acoustic peak occurs. There's a factor of pi in there. And so that makes, because we can measure this very accurately, this scale is measurable to better than a percent, the value of L where this peak occurs. We observe this ratio. It's like an observable thing. And you know, both of these numbers are complicated combinations of cosmological parameters. So on its own, making this measurement would pin down one complicated combination of these parameters. It'd be the first three parameters on the list that matter. If I were to go on a little bit more, I could tell you about more observables. Like there's the scale where this damping happens, the relative heights of the peaks, and so on. And it turns out that there are six observables in the CMB. There are six parameters, and you can solve for everything. So the CMB actually, on its own, pins down the six parameters of the standard cosmological model very well. I'll come back and say a lot more about this later. Here's a 3D example. Of course, when I plot it, I'll just show it in 2D slices. But the matter density field throughout the universe is a 3D field, and it has a 3D power spectrum. There's an obvious characteristic scale here of around, I think I quoted it last time as 40 megaparsecs. That would be 1 over k. That's just like a characteristic decorrelation length of matter fluctuations throughout the universe. And it comes up all the time if you're studying the behavior of matter density or potentials, like the way galaxies are distributed, anything that depends on matter fields well after the CMB is formed. If I take the Fourier transform of the power spectrum to get the correlation function, then there's something very interesting that happens. Here's the correlation function. This was, again, a case where I just took a plot from a paper. This was a SDSS paper. So the error bars are some data. And what I want to show in the plot is just the curve itself. I think the red curve is the one that you should pay attention to. This is the correlation function of the matter, or it's just the Fourier transform of the power spectrum over here. Your eye might be drawn to this little bump that happens at a particular scale at around 100 or 110 H inverse megaparsecs. There is, by the way, another scale in the plot, which is just sort of the decorrelation scale. That's the 40 megaparsecs that I talked about before. So this bump in the power spectrum, the peak at k of 0.02, shows up in the correlation function as sort of the characteristic decorrelation scale, the separation where this correlation function starts going to zero. But there's also a feature that is easy to see in the correlation function but harder to see in the power spectrum, this bump. It's there in the power spectrum. It has to be present somehow since they're Fourier transforms of each other. If you look very closely, you can see I don't know that you can see it in this plot, actually. I think you'd have to plot something slightly different. You can't see it in the plot, but it does show up as some very small wiggles, some oscillations around a perfectly wiggle-free curve. This is a very important bump. It's called the baryon acoustic oscillation feature in the correlation function. And our best measurements of the expansion history of the universe come from this bump. We use it as like a standard ruler. If you measure the correlation function of galaxies, then you see okay, if I have a galaxy here, then there's sort of a preference to have more galaxies nearby. And then that correlation drops off. And then when I get to out to like 100 megaparsecs, oh, suddenly there's like an excess probability to have a galaxy 100 megaparsecs away that wasn't there at 80 megaparsecs or 120 megaparsecs. That acts as like a standard ruler. We observe it at a given redshift, we observe it as an angle, and that lets us infer the distance to the redshift. This is the modern method. This is like the most statistically powerful and high-powered method for mapping out the expansion history or the distance to a given redshift as a function of the redshift. That's super fun. Here's a Gaussian random field with the power spectrum that I showed on the previous slide, the power spectrum of the density field. This is a pretty good model for what the density field of the universe would look like. If you looked on large enough scales, if this were a sufficiently zoomed out view of the universe, the real density field looks pretty nonlinear. Here's an n-body particle simulation. The density field ends up all clumped up in dark matter halos with filaments connecting them. But it is true that if I smooth this map, if I zoom this map out sufficiently and smooth it, then it will end up with something pretty Gaussian looking. So perhaps surprisingly, the Gaussian statistics are a good approximation on large scales. There's one more. So the large scales, when you do non-CMB cosmology, there's this sort of general rule that the large scales tend to be the easiest to interpret. It's easier to do the data analysis and tie them to cosmological parameters because you have linear theory and Gaussian fields. And as you go to smaller and smaller scales, things become more complicated. One last thing I want to do in the slides before I go back to the blackboard. This is kind of a technical point. When we talk about 2D fields, I've always been talking about 2D fields that are defined on like a flat XY plane. The 2D fields that we observe, like the cosmic microwave background, usually when we say 2D field, we mean a 2D field defined on the surface of a sphere. So I'll write that as a function of theta and phi, or a function of n, where n is a unit 3 vector. And on the sphere, the analog of the Fourier decomposition into plane waves is a decomposition into spherical harmonics. I'm sure you guys have seen these in some other context, but there are these special functions, YLM, the spherical harmonics, and they're just the analogs of plane waves for the sphere. They're parameterized by an integer L and an integer M, where L is an integer that can be 0, 1, 2, and so on. There are two L plus 1 possible values for M. Here are the first few spherical harmonics, laboriously cut and pasted from an article in Wikipedia. At L equals 0, there's only one M mode, and that's a monopole. At L equals 1, there are always two L plus 1, so there's three M modes, and those are dipole-like modes that correspond to the three coordinate directions. At L equals 2, there are five octopole-like modes, quadrupole is what we say in L equals 2. L equals 3 is called the octopole, and so on. In general, a spherical harmonic with a given value of L has a characteristic wavelength of 2 pi over L radians. So an L equals 100 mode would look like a regular patchwork of hot and cold spots, where the characteristic size of those hot and cold spots, the wavelength, is 2 pi radians divided by 100, or you could think of that as 360 degrees divided by 100. So these spots would be 3.6 degrees in size. That's all. I want to, when you talk about random fields on the sphere, you can really quickly devolve into a total mess of special functions. I'm going to say, we'll need to use a few of the properties of spherical harmonics, but I'm going to try to avoid getting too bogged down. So that's all for now. Come back to it tomorrow.